How much real change can one person make? Well, over the past 12 years since he founded the Central Asia Institute, Greg Mortensen has built over 50 schools in some of the most destitute parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And in the process, he's brought hope to an area that has been a terrorist breeding ground. Mr. Mortensen has teamed up with journalist David Oliver Rellen to chronicle his accomplishments in Three Cups of Tea, which is published by Viking. I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show. Hi.
Thanks.
What first brought you to Pakistan or this part of Pakistan?
I originally grew up in East Africa on the slopes of Kilimanjaro, and I had gotten into climbing. Also, my parents, my father set up a medical center. My mother started at a school over there. So I grew up in the third world. When I came back to the States, I joined the U.S. military. And I was first inspired to Pakistan to go mountain climbing, and I had gone there in honor of my sister Krista, who had died from severe epilepsy. So I decided to climb K2, which is the world's second highest mountain, considered one of the more difficult mountains to climb.
And what would have happened if you'd succeeded? Do you think your life would be very different?
Probably. I would probably come down and maybe giving some talks, and I would probably gone into neurophysiology. I wanted to be help find some cures for epilepsy, and that was my aspiration.
But where is K2? I thought it was in Nepal. It's in Pakistan?
K2 is in Pakistan, the Karakoram Mountains. It's about 1,000 miles west of Mount Everest, and it's on the China-Pakistan border. And to the south is the India-Kashmir.
Uh-huh. What happened when you tried to ascend K2?
Well, we spent 78 days there. It was very arduous. There was a lot of fatalities on the mountain. That year, 5 of the 12 people there died coming down the mountain. I didn't quite get to the top, and coming down, I was very weak, emaciated, and emotionally spent. I spent 5 days walking back to the nearest village where I could pick up a jeep, and I stumbled into the village, and the people there befriended me and helped me for a couple of days, nursed me back to health, and I was very touched by the hospitality.
This is the village of Corfe?
The village of Corfe. This is in the frontiers of civilization and a very abject poverty, but a very remote area.
And you're 6'4". You must have seemed very strange.
I was quite strange, and I had taken a wrong turn. The first chapter in the book is called Failure. And so I took a left turn instead of a right turn, and I stumbled into the village of Corfe. They had really not been around foreigners before. I was pretty haggard and also very kind of frightening looking with my long hair and blackened face. And they're very, very sincere. They shared everything they had with me, Paiucha, which is rancid Tibet tea. And I asked about a school. They took me up to a little dusty grove behind the village where I saw 84 children sitting in the dirt. And they had only 8 slate boards amongst them, and they were writing with sticks in the sand. Now, I grew up in Tanzania, so I've seen a lot of poverty, but I was touched by their resilience, and they asked me to help them build a school, so that's what I started doing.
Was this a madrasa?
No, it was just a formal school. There was just one teacher there who was shared with another village. Secular education, they were just reading, writing, and arithmetic, essentially, but very crude education.
Mm-hmm. Are we talking about a part of Pakistan that's anywhere near Afghanistan?
It's fairly near Afghanistan, up on the north. The valleys from the Karakoram go into the Hindu Kush Mountains and the Pamir Mountains of Afghanistan. It's fairly close, probably 300 miles.
Is this the area that we sometimes read about as being the untamed part of Pakistan, where the Pakistani government is afraid to venture?
Yeah, in many respects. And also, right in the K2 area is the line of control, the border between India and Pakistan, where there's been a conflict for the last 5 decades.
So this is where partly where the earthquake also recently happened.
And Azad Kashmir, and there's been 65,000 people killed by artillery fire and fighting between India and Pakistan in that area over the last 20 years.
Does that affect Corfe in particular?
Not substantially, except that a few young men often leave the village to go either join groups to insurgencies to fight against the Indian army, and some of them join the Pakistan military in a more formal basis.
My guest is Greg Mortensen, who with David Oliver Rellen has written Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Fight Terrorism and Build Nations, One School at a Time. So you promised to make to build a school out of gratitude. Our best intentions are often difficult to act upon. So how did you manage to keep your word?
Well, I came back to the States. I hand-typed 580 letters. I was computer illiterate. Only one check back from Tom Brokaw, the newscaster. I was very naive. I wrote to all the celebrities and dear Oprah, et cetera. I only got one check back. I wrote
from
16.
Tom Brokaw. He's a very generous guy.
He's wonderful. And, 16 grants. They were all turned down. About 7 months later, I had $2,000 of the $12,000 I needed. I went to an elementary school in River Falls, Wisconsin, where the children started a pennies drive, pennies for Pakistan. And I didn't think much of it, but 6 weeks later, they had raised 62,340 pennies for this project. And it was really kids who reached out in their sincerity, and that started sparking off dollars from adults. But it was really kids who got this going.
And then Jean Hernie, is that his name? He got involved?
This is a Swiss physicist who invented the planar process in 57 that became the prototype of the microchip. So he was very curious of what this strange American was doing in the middle of nowhere trying to build a school in Pakistan. So he started funding our projects and eventually set up the Central Asia Institute, which is our nonprofit organization at the time. And I went back to Corfe. They were shocked not only to come back, but I had fulfilled my promise. But they said we hadn't thought about the fact we had to build a bridge first. So then I had to come back to States, raise $10,000. The next year, build a bridge. Year three, I went there. Things were going rather slow. I had my plumb line receipts and records and determined not to lose a dollar. And the old village chief, Haji Ali, who's this very kind of ornery but very benevolent man, he taught me the most important lesson I had to learn. He said, "We're grateful to Allah that you've come to help us, but you need to do one thing. You need to sit down and shut up and let us do the work." And he took everything I had and locked it up. And of course, 6 weeks later, the school got built, and it took 3 years to build the first school.
But often, development in rural areas can be a mixed blessing and even culturally destructive. How do you improve the quality of life of people without stepping on their toes, and also perhaps doing something that they'll find offensive?
Well, I do one thing. You do a lot. I listen a lot. I think in development we often have our ideas, especially recently in the Pakistan earthquake. The aid has been very ineffective, but there's things being helicoptered in and support being set up. But the refugees have been moved by displaced tectonic plates and watersheds, so the villages essentially are in very poor areas. But the way we're going about this is setting up villages in the most extreme remote areas, often volatile areas or areas of war, at the end of the valley. So I figure if we can put a school there, that certainly we can build schools in the more proximity of the UN or the big aid organizations. And number two, I really focus on, to me, watching a girl walk down a trail into school the first time is like man walking on the moon.
But girls, educating girls goes against the traditions of many people in this part of the world, doesn't it?
It does.
Doesn't that cause more tension?
I had to learn the hard way. I had a fatwa issued against me by Aga Mubarak. He's one of the powerful mullahs in northern Pakistan. And the prohibition, that case went to the High Shariat Court in Pakistan, which is the kind of ultimate authority.
Now, what does a fatwa mean? In the case of Salman Rushdie, it meant you killed a guy
death
and you'll get a lot of money. Was this also calling for your death?
No, this was calling for my prohibition, basically boot me out of the country. And a fatwa could be against television or women wearing certain type of attire. In my case, it was you have to quit educating the girls, and you need to leave the country.
They were afraid that you were going to westernize the village and corrupt everybody.
And interesting, it was the mullah who issued the fatwa, but the community wanted the school. And we find that in everywhere we go, that the communities are very interested in education, and they actually took this case to the High Sharia Court. After 2 years, it was rescinded, the fatwa, and it became kind of set a standard in northern Pakistan for education.
Well, the fatwa wasn't the worst of your problems. You've had some pretty scary things happen. Weren't you abducted in Afghanistan once?
I was abducted in 96 in July in Waziristan, the tribal areas of Northwest Frontier Province in Pakistan. I had gone in there to look at some new school locations, and during the night, 12 gunmen burst in the room. I was detained for 8 days. At first, I was blindfolded. I was held. I wasn't misabused, but it was frightening, and I knew I had to befriend my captors. The third day, I asked for a Quran, and I had somebody, a mullah, come and start teaching me about Islam. And then the sixth day, I knew I had to put pressure on them, so I asked them, I told them that my wife was pregnant and was due to have a son in the near future, and a son is held in high esteem there. And that kind of won them a little bit. And in the end...
Well, what do you think they wanted from you? Were they just holding you for ransom?
I became a bartering chip in a tribal clan dispute. And at the end, the resolution was that I was released, but the opposition warlord had his compound bombed, and so I became this kind of wandering, free bait coming into the middle of a clan dispute. And I think one thing that I found in Islam that I very rarely hear about here in the U.S., especially in the media, is that when a young man goes on jihad, he has to get permission from his mother and the blessings. And it's actually a fairly solemn ceremony. And if he does not get permission or he skirts that, he will be held in disgrace, or it's a big embarrassment. You look at 9/11, the hijackers were all literate, they were educated, but their mothers, most of them, are not educated. And in the SWAS I'm working in, when the mother becomes educated, she's much less likely to endorse her son going on jihad.
So we can only hope that these girls grow up very fast. My guest is Greg Mortensen, who has written with David Oliver Rellin, Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Fight Terrorism and Build Nations, One School at a Time. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. What's the significance of the title, Three Cups of Tea?
Three Cups of Tea. The first cup, you're a stranger. Second, you become a friend. And third cup, family. And the process takes several years. Here we have 2-minute football drills and 30-minute power lunches. And when you become family, it's a very tribal society. I think we think in terms of Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan as nationalistic type of feeling, but it's tribal and it's also sectarian, the Shia and the Sunnis. An example is my wife was sitting in a Jeep with my daughter once. My family comes over, not often, but sometimes. A man looked at her in the wrong way, kind of leered at her, and the people with me took him behind the building and beat him unconscious. And they came back and apologized profusely to me that this man had looked at my wife in the wrong way. She never even knew it had happened to her.
But they noticed it, obviously.
They noticed it.
These people who are Pashtun, mostly?
Pashtun, and some areas are Balti. I work with 12 ethnic groups. They're very different, and learning their ideology. The one thing that becomes fairly standard, though, is the tribal etiquette. And I've spoke up at the Pentagon about tribal warfare. Often when two feuding clans go to battle, they have a much better ability to negotiate or confront or dialogue to a much greater degree than we do here in the West. And not only will they set the terms of engagement, but they will decide how you can win the fight or the dispute. And then
with the least amount of bloodshed.
Least amount of bloodshed. And then the victor has to take care of the vanquished widows and orphans. And so a winning warlord will often have several widows and children in his compound.
So shock and awe would be totally beyond the way that they would imagine going after somebody.
Oh, certainly. And like in Afghanistan, when there were civilian casualties at the daily Rumsfeld debriefings. They would talk about terrorists killed but never address the civilians. I was very adamant that we start looking at those people and helping them. And after 9/11, Mullah Omar desperately was the leader of the Taliban, was trying to contact the White House because he knew that Osama would be his demise. And there was no meeting held, but he called a grand shura, the 1,200 leaders, to discuss and debate this. And they all said we should turn in Osama. But because he couldn't talk with the enemy, And who knows if that would have changed anything, but even the most bitter enemies there will often try to sort out their problems first.
He couldn't talk to the enemy because the United States refused to respond?
I guess he tried to call the White House. He had no clue what he was doing. Some
Hello,
switchboard
answered him. Washington information. This is Mullah Omar. Where were you on 9/11?
I was in Pakistan. I was in a Zoot Khan village up on the Afghan border, a very tribal area. Afterwards, most foreigners fled. I decided to remain there and finish up my work.
And what were people telling you about what happened?
First of all, we were worried about a massive U.S. retaliation, so we kind of were worried about a bombing that would take place. Secondly, the mullahs invited me for prayers of peace. A widow named Hawa brought eggs to bring to the widows in New York. I was very touched by their outpouring of sympathy, and they surrounded me with this protective kind of cordon that I really don't need. And then coming back here, I came back on Halloween about almost 2 months after 9/11. Went down into my basement, and my only quote in the media had been that this is a very complex situation. We need to use restraint rather than lash out in retribution and understand what's behind this. And I started getting hate mail and death threats. This is from Americans and not from people over there.
Well, initially you thought that the invasion of Afghanistan was a good idea. How soon before you changed your mind? Or at least the way, I'm sure you still felt it was the right approach. Did you just think it was done poorly?
Well, done poorly without any, it's the same in Iraq. There's military victories are very easy, but the winning the hearts and the minds is where we failed significantly. I had been distraught for years because I had seen what had happened with the Taliban there, the killing of people, the oppression of women. There's widows on the Panj River that were being they were lobbing RPGs out just for sport, and it was very disturbing to me. On the other hand,
that misogynistic.
It was in some areas, and although most of it had to do with Sunni and Shia issues, and the Taliban are from the a certain clan of the Deoband sect of and the Wahhabi, or maybe the Al Qaeda composed maybe a Wahhabi from the Sunni one of the Sunni subsects, and a lot of their disputes are more Sunni Shia related than actually about Taliban. And education, even. What I found is that where I go now, we have several girls' schools in former Taliban strongholds, and the people there are very, very keen on getting education for the girls. There's a few elements that are they want to stop that, but the majority of people there are interested in education. If you educate the boy, you educate the individual, but if you educate the girl, you educate the community.
The success of these various projects rested as much on the efforts of other people as on you. Syed Abbas stands out among them in my mind. What did he do?
Syed Abbas Rizvi is a head Shiite cleric in northern Pakistan, a very powerful man.
I didn't realize there were that many Shiites in northern Pakistan. I thought it was pretty much all Sunni.
Pakistan's about 84% Sunni and maybe 16 or 15% Shia, and then you have the Ismailis and Christians. And the Shia are very linked with Iran and also the Hezbollah, and you go into Lebanon and Palestine. Another mullah, this is my number two fatwa, but a mullah issued a fatwa against me because I was a kafir or a non-believer. This is a Shia mullah. Syed Abbas Rizvi wrote to the Council of Ayatollahs in Qom, Iran, to get validation on this fatwa. And about 8 months later, I was summoned in the inner sanctum of Imam Bar Mosque in Skardu, northern Pakistan. I sat there. I thought I'd get kicked out of the country, but instead he brought me a letter in the ornate Farsi script in a red velvet box. He opened it, and that letter said, "Dear Compassion of the Poor, in our Holy Quran, education is encouraged for all our children. And furthermore, what you're doing as a non-believer kafir is in the highest principles of Islam." So with that letter was an endorsement, and we've since then hundreds of requests for schools.
Isn't part of the problem that there are so many different ways of interpreting Islam, and that the local religious leader, the imam or whatever, the mullah, whatever he is in that area, to some degree becomes the arbiter of how to interpret? In this case, somebody who had the best interests of his local people in mind interpreted it in your behalf. It might have gone the other way.
It could have easily gone the other way, and often tied into this is good old-fashioned Western capitalism. Often we get a fatwa or some decree. It's because of money and a contract. We do contracts with local communities, but the mullah has the money and the power, so he wants us to do the contract with him. It's the same with the UN and UNICEF and other organizations. And the most important thing is, I think also to discern, is that our greatest ally there in that region of fragmented peace is a moderate Muslim majority, and we fail to build bridges with them. The most madrasas are same as a catechism or bar mitzvah confirmation, and 99% of them, but there's another about 18,000 that are very radical ideology. And often in the media, we misperceive that all madrasas are bad, and most kids go to madrasas just to learn about Islam and the Quran.
My guest is Greg Mortensen. His book, Three Cups of Tea, written with David Oliver Rellin, is published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Greg Mortensen, Mortenson, who's written with David Oliver Rellin, Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Fight Terrorism and Build Nations, One School at a Time, published by Viking. You created the Central Asia Institute, the CAI. Is this an NGO?
It's a 501c3 nonprofit. It was actually the creation of Dr. Jean Hairney, the Swiss physicist. I was working in Pakistan. He was dying from leukemia. He set up this organization. He had much grander aspirations than I did, but it was the kind of the body that we started working with as a nonprofit.
And this was to build more schools and other things?
Schools, and he had visions of expanding into greater Central Asia. So far, I've remained in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and I probably will end up staying there for the rest of my life.
Although you also we're running this from on a shoestring budget from Bozeman, Montana, in a basement. Do people ever confuse CAI with CIA?
Yeah, both here and then overseas. So we've thought perhaps we might need to change the name at some point.
Well, you have won over warlords, clerics, villagers, young and old. What about American politicians? Are they strongly in support of what you're trying to do here?
We've never taken $1 of federal support. The Pentagon offered us $2.2 million last year to build schools. However, they had an agenda that we had to target them in certain areas, and we let the communities decide where the schools go, so that didn't fit it. But our biggest supporter is Congresswoman Mary Bono. She's Republican from Palm Springs, but we have
Sonny's widow.
And I find that we have support from conservatives, liberals. I've been able to sit in with several congressmen and senators and talk to them about the issues there. I think the biggest compelling issue is that we are really failing to address education needs, and especially for girls. An example is that there are, in the world, there's 154 million children deprived of education because of religious extremism or sexual discrimination. And the cost to achieve global literacy would be $8 billion for the next 15 years. Last year, we sent $94.2 billion to Iraq for the war on terror, and it cost about a dollar per month to educate a child in that part of the world. And more than that, we pledged, say, in Pakistan last year, $557 million to the earthquake relief. Now, our budget's under $1 million, so I'm talking about a lot of money here. The U.S. government pledged that. We've only sent over $310 million. Most of that's for military activities like our Chinook helicopters that are bringing relief. So you have about 1 million children displaced from the earthquake. 9,000 schools destroyed this week. Those kids are going back to school, but there's no school. A lot of those children are in refugee camps, and including probably 500,000 run by terrorist-labeled groups, the Jamaat Islami, the Al-Rashid Trust, which is run by Dr. Aziz Amir, who's the personal previous physician of Osama bin Laden. And they're providing very critical food, shelter, health care, as these people are down and out, so they have nowhere to go. But inside of all those camps, there's huge madrasas, there's big tents. They brought in hundreds of teachers to teach extremist Quran. And with the
we're ceding all of this to them.
These are incubators. And with the recent NSA, National Security Agency, what they've stated is that we're not allowed to talk to these people. We can't render them aid. So we basically are creating this virulent incubator. Right down the street from the Al-Rashid Trust is a MASH 212 U.S. military unit providing health care, like a MASH unit in Korea. But the Al-Rashid Trust is doing many more surgical procedures. And so it's a very interesting watching this unhappen. But basically I see this going back to Afghanistan in 1989 when the Soviets left. The Mujahideen, the freedom fighters who the U.S. helped to overthrow the Afghanistan, the Soviet army, there's a very similar parallel to what's happening now in Pakistan after the earthquake.
Also with Hamas, which initially started off offering welfare and medical services and then later did other things, but many people in this country are unaware that they got themselves an awful lot of supporters simply because they were the only ones who were offering certain services at the time. So the same thing is happening now with the Taliban and related groups. How much would a school that would offer an alternative cost to build? You've built 50 of them so far.
The school is about between $12,000 and $20,000, depending on size and location.
We're talking about very little money in American terms.
And then all you have to add in is about $1 per month per child for ongoing education. So for $30,000, $35,000, you can set up a school that will eventually have 300-400 children and be ongoing for several years.
Although, as you suggest, there's no way you could take money from the federal government because that would taint what you're doing.
If we could take money from the government but still allow those villages to have communities to control we basically do a 50-50 deal. The villages provide sweat equity, free labor resources. We provide skilled labor and then the teacher training education. If they would agree to that model, then we could accept federal money.
My guest is Greg Mortensen. His book, written with David Oliver Ellen, is Three Cups of Tea. It is published by Viking. You're known by the people in the area as Dr. Greg. Are you a doctor as well?
No, I'm not a physician. I have sometimes helped. I've taught a lot of things to the people about hygiene, sanitation, nutrition. We've introduced that in the curriculum. So it's kind of a term of enamorment. I'm not old enough yet to be a cha-cha or an apo or a kaka, which is a respectful term for an elderly, elder. So hopefully I'll get there soon. I get a few more gray hairs and they'll call me cha-cha.
But you had the example of your father, didn't you, when he was in Tanzania?
My father was a very big influence in my life. We spent about 14 years in Tanganyika, which turned into Tanzania in the 60s. He set up a hospital, but he did it in a similar model. It took him 10 years to raise $6.2 million, but he didn't raise the last $5 million until the last year. It took him 9 years. And when we inaugurated the hospital, it was a beautiful ceremony. Julius Nyerere, who was the initial president, gave an incredible speech. And then my father got up, and he gave a speech that said that in 10 years, all the staff here will be heads of department, will be Tanzanian, they'll be locals. And the expats kind of scoffed at him, and he essentially lost his job after that as an administrator. And my father came back. He passed away early in his 40s from cancer, but 10 years later, all the department heads were Tanzanian. And I think it's important to recognize in all those endeavors the community input.
Well, you actually have done a little bit of medical work. You saved a villager who was suffering from toxic shock after childbirth, didn't you?
This is in Corfe, and a woman was, she had a child. She was in toxic shock about 2 days after birth. She was afraid to nurse her baby because she thought she was poisoned. Her placenta hadn't come out yet. And when you nurse, it excretes oxytocin, which stimulates the placenta, the uterus, to expel the placenta. And so finally, she had a thready pulse and about to die. So with her husband's request, I manually extracted her placenta, and then we massaged her fundus, which is the belly, and then we got her to nurse her baby later, and she recovered from that. So I think that's where my Dr. Greg started out.
Meanwhile, you must experience all sorts of culture shock when you come back to the United States. Do you miss yak butter and things like that?
Oh, yes, I do. And this last trip, I was there for about 6 weeks after the earthquake over Christmas and the holidays. I came back here. This is my 31st trip to that area, and I came back, and it took quite a while to kind of recover from that, so it's always not easy.
Is there culture shock when you go from Pakistan to Afghanistan?
No culture shock there, and going over there is like going back home, and I'm from Montana, so we do have some rural elements in Montana, but it's always a transition. On the other hand, I feel very blessed because I see the wonderful the kindness of the people there and the goodness of the people of America, and I feel very fortunate because I see the polarity in our society, and I see more pessimism. I see more fear. We live in fear so much, and because of what I see, I choose to remain in hope, and I can be optimistic, even though it sounds a little bit crazy.
Well, do people distinguish between you and what you're doing and what the American government does? Because we just saw when President Bush visited India and Pakistan, there were many people who were very angry with Americans in general. But I suspect that once they get to know people, they feel differently.
They do, and I've met with like Faisal Rahman, who's the extremist leader of the coalition MMA party, which is Musharraf's opposition party. He's from the tribal areas where a lot of this volatility is going on right now, and there's a conflict between the Pakistan army and the tribals. And even he said he has four daughters. He wants them to they are going to school, but they were very keen to invite me to come into Waziristan, which is where supposedly Osama might be hiding, and put schools in there. I think there's another misperception that you really can't plug in democracy. You have to build democracy, and it starts with education, including for the girls and women. You have education, and then with that, later on becomes land ownership, and then with that becomes like women's suffrage, and then the right to vote.
Well, you had 12 years of building schools, so some of your students must have graduated. What happens when you go back to the towns where you built your first schools?
Well, it's a wonderful experience to see the kids and the mothers who were little girls at one time, and I also see there are some things that happen that aren't so good. Like you see the brain drain, you see kids leaving the villages, you see there's still infant mortality. When you reduce infant mortality, it increases the amount of people initially, and so you have more hungry mouths to feed. And the only way to really look at long-term solutions is to plan these things in about 40 years. So you have to, eventually with education, there's decreased infant mortality, and with that, the population will start to decrease, but it takes about 40 years.
But you're seeing changes in the communities since the schools were built?
Especially where there's girls going to school. One is just basic hygiene, sanitation, nutrition. You'll see washing the hands. There's more order in the kitchen. There's these, and also, in a more psychological basis, it's kind of like where we had out west, say 150 years ago. Girls who are literate can write letters to the extended family for the mother. When the mother gets married, her ties are severed, and so they are able to communicate through the like a pony stagecoach type of letters.
Has the war in Iraq changed the nature of your work or affected the way people relate to you?
Not too much. Most people, I think their main gripe, this is an average person in the village, was that we didn't work with the UN on this. They see the UN as part of the tribal community, the only voice on the world arena that they have in Pakistan or Afghanistan is with the UN. They feel that, and we disavowed a lot of the things the UN have been doing, and so that was and I think that alienated us tremendously, just as much as the invasion of Iraq.
You mentioned the brain drain. Well, aren't you caught up in that? Because if you encourage people to know more than just what's happening in their local area, aren't you, in a way, encouraging them also to move away?
In some cases, that happens, and it's inevitable that some kids and students will leave, try to get jobs. On the other hand, as I said before, you educate a boy, educate an individual, but it's the girls who stay behind when they become mothers. Most of them remain in their villages, and that's kind of how you perpetuate or instill the values of education in those communities.
People can learn more about your organization by getting in touch with what website?
Our website is Central Asia Institute, and it's ICAT.org, ICAT.org.
And Greg Mortensen's book is called Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Fight Terrorism and Build Nations One School at a Time. It is published by Viking. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. And by the way, Greg will be giving a photo presentation and signing copies of his book tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at Astor Place. Thank you so much for coming by here.
Thanks.